This is Jim Inkster coming today. On the show we will have is our primary guest, former Congressman Don Cashew. He served in the U.S. House of Representatives for less than a year, and he was unseated by none other than William Morgan Cassidy, who 2 weeks from today will be on the ballot as a U.S. Senate hopeful against Mary Loretta Landrieu Snellings. Mary Landrieu was in Baton Rouge yesterday, and with her, side by side, was the 42nd American president, Bill Clinton. And we'll talk about this race as Don Cashew has some inside knowledge of both of the primary candidates and much more from the man who also served as the United States Attorney for the Middle District of Louisiana for 3 years. Back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Our guest is former Congressman Don Cashew, pride of New Roads, a Democrat, who on May 3rd, 2008, succeeded Richard Hugh Baker in Congress, defeated Woody Jenkins in a runoff. Don Cashew was sworn in May of 2008, May 6th to be exact, and by January he was out of a job. It was a short term on Capitol Hill for you.
Yes, sir. That was short and sweet, but no, it was a great honor to be able to do it, but unfortunately the voters didn't want me to go back.
And now we have an array of candidates running for the 6th District seat that's being vacated once again, and we'll talk about that with Don Cashew. But also, the U.S. Senate race has the man who defeated you, William Cassidy. He's running as the Republican flag bearer for all intents and purposes, and he is trying to unseat Mary Landrieu. And as you know, it's tough being a Democrat in the age of Obama in Louisiana.
Yes, sir. I mean, that is pretty much the extent of Congressman Cassidy's campaign, and that is just to attempt to tie Senator Landrieu to Obama. Basically, that's the whole campaign message coming out of the Cassidy campaign, and I think that's sort of the message across the South in these competitive senatorial races. Basically, just trying to tie the Democratic candidate to President Obama.
Now, you stayed a Democrat, but you had overtures from the Republican Party, didn't you, at some point?
Yes, sir.
Why did you remain a Democrat?
Well, Jim, as I think I've told you before, when I first ran for office, and I tell this to people sometimes, when I first ran for the state house before 2000, 1999, I was not... I didn't consider myself a Democrat or Republican. I voted for the person, as most Louisianans do. I went in very nonpartisan, wanted to solve problems, and I continued that approach pretty much throughout my career. However, with that said, I believe that the Democrats allow the people who bear that name, bear the Democratic label, to actually try to solve problems. They're not. I don't think they hold their candidates. They hold their public servants who are Democrats to the same ideological rigor that the Republicans do. And so, I believe the Democratic Party is the party of problem solvers. They attempt to. Mm-hmm. It's not a trickle down type theory. There are we understand. I understand that business has a great role, and we have to make sure we encourage and make sure that businesses can thrive. However, that's not the only thing that we need to help people succeed, help people to have the opportunity to succeed. I think that's the main thing that sort of differentiates Republicans from Democrats, from my standpoint.
Right. Well, Don Cashew was a member of the Louisiana House of Representatives and then the U.S. House for a brief period, May 3rd through January 3rd, and technically May 6th was the day he took office, so we're talking less than 8 months you were on Capitol Hill. You really liked the job, though, didn't you?
Well, I liked it. It was certainly, like I said, a terrific honor. You know, I spent a lot of my time raising money for the next election, so that was not a particularly attractive part of the job. But no, being there, trying to be a part of solutions that would help Americans succeed was very gratifying, and yeah, certainly would have liked to have spent more time there, but didn't get that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you had accept the overture to become a Republican, and this is me talking, I have a feeling there never would have been Bill Cassidy in Congress, and it's quite possible you would, if you had accepted the call to become a member of the GOP, you would be the U.S. Senate candidate right now running against Mary Landrieu. Now, Cassidy, who used to be a Democrat before he went into public life, he's had an epiphany on various issues. You weren't ready to have that epiphany.
No, I haven't had that epiphany, and probably will never have that epiphany. I mean, I am a Democrat. I do believe that that we have to focus on trying to help people gain opportunities to succeed, and I do believe that the Democratic Party does that better than the Republican Party.
297-5633 for Don Cashew, who paid the price for principle over party. He decided he wanted to be a Democrat. Now, there are people who agree with him, and there are others who disagree, but he made a choice. It was not in his best interest as far as his electability, and he paid the price in 2008. And that was an unusual year. That was a year of the closed primary. So in those events, for example, we had a closed primary today. In 2 weeks, we would select a U.S. senator. It wouldn't matter if you get 45% or 42. If they finish first, they're the U.S. senator. Cassidy did not get 50%.
Right, right. And yeah, that, and the irony is that this election, I think everyone is predicting Senator Landrieu to be ahead at the end of this primary. Had it been in under the old, and I say the old, it was actually only it was old for only a couple of different cycles. It didn't last long, the closed primary system. That was a change from the open primary that we have now. But anyway, had this election been under this closed primary system, then, you know, I think Senator Landrieu's path to victory would be pretty simple.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that Bill Cassidy, he benefited from the plurality system when he ran for Congress, and now he's benefiting from the majority system as he runs for the U.S. Senate. In 2008, Bill Cassidy received 48% of the votes. Don Cashew got 40 and Michael Jackson got 12. So the 36,000 votes that went to Michael Jackson, had 25,000 of those gone to you and 11,000 gone to Cassidy, you would have been the congressman, and most people believe that you would have gotten at least that many of Jackson's votes.
I think that's a fair guess or estimate. I believe a lot of his voters would have voted for me.
Okay. Well, the U.S. Senate election, Mary Landrieu, in 2008, she got 988,000 votes, and John Kennedy got 867,000 votes. So she won by 121,000 votes on a day in which Barack Obama got creamed by John McCain in the state. So she at least once has shown the ability to defy the tide that is sweeping to the right in Louisiana. Can she do it again?
I think she can, Jim. I mean, it's a tough race. I mean, and it's tough. The message and the drumbeat is even stronger and louder with respect to the anti-President Obama sentiment. But I do think that she's trending forward right now. I believe she just got 500 or so endorsements from elected officials across the state. I think you've seen this latest commercial with four prominent Republicans standing up and saying that, you know, we need her in the Senate, we need her clout, we need her chairmanship. So I do believe she's going to be able to fight off this sort of anti-President Obama.
And now the New York Times a few days ago, in calculating all the computer, putting in a computer all the polling information, came up with a 90% probability that Cassidy would win this race. Now, I think that's a bit high, but But I think at this point he should be considered the favorite.
He possibly could be, but as you and I think were speaking before the broadcast, 23% of the electorate are still undecided according to the polls, and so I think people are having a hard time making up their minds, and as opposed to, I think the conventional wisdom would say that's against the incumbent. However, I don't think that at all. I think it's probably just the opposite, and that's because the anti-Obama sentiment is very, very strong here in Louisiana. We know that. There's no getting around that. I think some of the polls show that there is a strong his approval rating. They strongly disapprove of his job, the job that he's been doing by 52%. Strongly, that's pretty doggone. You know, that's right. That's pretty big. So
well, he and the governor are about in the same place in Louisiana right now, which is kind of interesting because we've got polar opposites politically, and yet both of them are highly unpopular in the state. Yesterday, that was evidenced at the 6th District debate when Lenar Whitney, who's considered a Bobby Jindal backer, she gave him a 4. A 4. Now, Garrett Graves did give him a 10, but she gave him a 4.
Sure.
In fact, Garrett Graves, the only thing he criticized Jindal for was accepting the legislative pay raise, and ultimately he vetoed that.
Yes, sir.
So he criticized him for something didn't do.
Well, and that's sort of funny because I do believe that if you see an election cycle where the Senate goes entirely Republican, you're going to see an agenda very similar to what Governor Jindal has done here in Louisiana. I mean, it's a far right agenda. I'm not going to say it's a Republican agenda even. It's a far right agenda. And it just creates massive problems for just the middle class, the working poor. It just puts people really, really in difficult situations. And we're seeing what's happening in Louisiana right now. And I think that kind of thing could happen in the country if we elect a Republican Congress and Senate.
297-5633, and we will go to the phones in just a bit. But there are those, Don Cashew, who say that the Democratic Party on a national level has a far-left agenda. And a conservative Democrat like you might feel more comfortable as a Republican than as a member of a party where the party has moved leftward and not in line with Louisiana.
And that's true. The Democratic Party nationally can be a little left than most of us in Louisiana. Certainly, more so than me, and more so than Senator Landrieu. I think she's considered one of the least partisan senators in Congress right now. And so the question is, yes, why do we stay Democrats? Again, it goes back to what is our ultimate goal? I mean, what do we think government should or should not do? And if we think that government can play a role in solving problems, I believe the Democratic Party is the right place because I think you don't have to take that ideological stance that some of the far right ideologies proclaim, and that you can still work with the left in terms of, look, you may want all these programs. How are you going to pay for them? Yeah, I like some of their goals, but no, some of it is just pie in the sky. And so a conservative Democrat can actually put a little practicality, a little pragmatism there to help enact good programs that we can pay for that don't bankrupt the country. So I think there's a great need for conservative Democrats.
All right. Well, yesterday, Mary Landrieu was at the Hilton with William Jefferson Clinton, the 42nd American president and the 42nd governor of Arkansas. She looks almost radiant, basking in his aura. He is popular in Louisiana and everywhere. It is an amazing transformation for a man who was literally on the ropes in 1998. After all, he was impeached.
Yes, sir.
Can't even practice law.
Pretty incredible, to be honest, yes.
And Don Cashew is practicing law now, a former U.S. attorney with Lane Ewing, and we'll talk with him about that and about the election season. 2 weeks from today, we will be casting ballots for U.S. Senate, for Congress, and lots of other things. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Don Cashew is the guest, the former congressman, former U.S. attorney, former state house member, the pride of New Roads, and a man who bullishly is remaining a Democrat. He went to Georgetown, which is the alma mater of William Jefferson Clinton. You went to law school there.
Yes, sir.
He was an undergraduate. In fact, the only United States president to have graduated from a Catholic university is William Jefferson Clinton. So Georgetown gave you an indoctrination into Washington. It's an intoxicating place. I'm surprised you didn't switch parties just to stay there.
Well, I liked being there, but also love Louisiana too. So I don't think I would have. I never wanted to live there. You know, it wasn't that intoxicating.
Didn't have Potomac fever.
No, sir.
Chico on corporate. Chico, good morning. You're on with Congressman Cashew.
Good morning. What a great day to be an American.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to give you two quotes, and then I'm going to ask a question. Thomas Jefferson once said, any government that can give you anything you want has the power to take it all away. And then someone else, I can't remember his name, but I believe it was the gentleman who wrote on Walden Pond, said the government is at best to be only an expedient of the people and nothing more. So really, I feel government should just get out of the way and let us do most of it.
Okay.
We have an economic boom coming to this state, which is $20 to $50 billion, of which I'm participating in little by little with my own company, and I see it growing. How do you explain the extremely low unemployment rate in Louisiana, and I'm going to take it off the air. Thank you.
Well, you bring up a few good points. First of all, the expedient of the people, and the first quote: allowing government to give anything you want gives them the power to take anything away. The point I believe that's important is that if you look at the blue dogs in the House and the Congressional House, although they're not many anymore, but the blue dog version of governing focused on making those tough decisions. In other words, if you're going to pass a program that may help somebody, for instance, that we passed a great veterans bill that allowed veterans to get additional education. If you're going to pass those bills, you need to pay for it. You either need to cut somewhere else in the budget, or you're going to create some revenue. It makes you make those tough decisions. And it doesn't create these things out of the air where you don't have to make a choice between something now or in the future. But you're right. I mean, to a degree, we always have to be careful that we don't overstep when we're trying to govern. Getting out the way is a good thing. I agree with that. But it's not the only thing. You can't. You're just not going to be able to help people if you just think that the laissez-faire capitalistic market is going to take care of everything. That's just not how it works. Now on the idea of a low unemployment rate in Louisiana, I think everybody knows Louisiana has benefited from Haynesville shale, and since then, since the fracking has come along, we know natural gas prices have gone down, and we've had a manufacturing renaissance here with the chemical industry, and it's due to those lower natural gas prices. So that's why our unemployment rate is down, and I think anybody will tell you that.
Jim on I-10. Jim, good morning. You're on the air with Don Cashew.
Hey, Jim. How you doing?
Fine.
I wanted to say I'm tired of hearing this concept of if you can't pay for it, you shouldn't do it. Someone has to admit that the sole center of all of this is outsourcing of jobs. And that can be turned around if you tariff the outsourcing firms to death and not allow them into our system.
Well, that's the free trade argument, and we were with President Clinton yesterday, and he was a big free trade proponent, and he created a lot of jobs by doing that. And now, there is the concept of fair trade. Do you make sure that the countries that we're dealing with have some type of fair wages that need to be paid in those countries, that they have some type of environmental program that protects the environment. So those are difficult issues. They're not. It's certainly not as cut and dry, I believe, as that comment would lead you to believe.
Dan downtown. Good morning, Dan. You're on with Don Casu.
Yeah, so do you believe that the congressional Republicans have forfeited their independence to right-wing Alec and Grover Norquist?
I do believe that those outside groups are having an inordinate effect. I mean, they certainly are all pledging not to raise taxes, and that when they make those pledges, it interferes with their ability to make decisions. Because even the elimination of tax breaks are considered to be raising of taxes. So you have these tax breaks such as the hedge fund managers who are treated as their income is treated as capital gains as opposed to income, and you know they've refused to change that loophole. I mean, it's an incredible benefit to these multi-billionaires, and it just doesn't make any sense that we wouldn't eliminate that to pay for some of these other things that we're trying to that we need.
Jim on airline. Jim, good morning. You're on WRKF.
Gentlemen, I do think it's a bit short-sighted to truly put so many of our eggs in the fracking basket, especially considering that our state is basically one giant water table, and the injection of those fracking chemicals into the water table is far from good, and we now actually have proof that the re-injection of water following fracking is what's causing seismic issues. And what is that going to do to the salt domes that not only do we depend upon for storage, but also just for basic structure?
Jim, yeah, I mean, I think those issues, we certainly have to keep an eye on that. In Louisiana, you know, we are doing some fracking, but most of the fracking is occurring, you know, outside of this state. That's where most of the benefit is coming from in terms of natural gas. That doesn't mean we shouldn't care what's going on with the environment there. But I do want to suggest that we're benefiting here in Louisiana from those low natural gas prices. But yes, certainly environmentally, we have to keep an eye on that and make sure we're not creating some serious problems.
Josh at LSU. Josh, good morning. You're on with Congressman Casu.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Congressman Casu. I had a question. I mean, I'm 21. I haven't been paying attention to politics that long. I'm just curious, is the level of hate against this American president and this GOP obstructionist agenda that we're seeing higher than it's ever been in history?
Well, it's pretty high in terms of the hate for the president. In fact, during my lifetime, I haven't heard it this high. Jim, you're not much older than me, but you may be able to speak to it from a historical perspective. But no, I do believe that I think that's a big turnoff for a lot of people. The negative campaigning, the negative almost hysteria towards President Obama, I believe, sort of turns people off from actually going out and voting. So, Josh, I hope that you still go out and vote, even though you're hearing some of this pretty strong rhetoric.
Well, these candidates who, when they're asked to rate Obama, they give him a zero. I saw Cedric Richmond the other night, the congressman, and he was truly appalled that Congressman Cassidy had given Obama a zero. He said the Dow's gone from 7,000 to more than 16,000. Unemployment's gone from 7% to 5.9%. The deficit was at $1.5 trillion. Now it's at $490 billion. So it's been cut by two-thirds. He says, how can you give the man a zero? But yet, if you were to ask Democrats a few years back to rate Bush, I'm sure many of them would have given him a zero. And you got there's Republicans giving Obama a zero. They won't give anybody any credit for anything they've done if they're on the other side of the fence, it seems.
That may be true to an extent, Jim. I ran during, you know, President Bush was still in office, and so certainly, you know, was speaking with some of my voters, and they were not happy with the president. But I just didn't hear the level of vitriol that I'm hearing now about President Obama. It's just it's almost an hysteria. It's not, to me, it's not based. You just brought up the good points. If you ask the question, are you better off now than you were in 2008? The economy and everything else is vastly, vastly better. So normally that he would be giving, be getting and receiving high marks. But for whatever reason, people are not seeing it that
way. Well, he does receive high marks in other parts of the country. So this has become a regional thing to some extent. The South is red. The Midwest is largely red. And the rest of the country is blue, except for a few states in the West with very few voters, like Wyoming. But it's a division in America right now.
No doubt. No doubt.
And back in 1976, hard as it is to believe, Jimmy Carter lost California and carried Texas.
That is hard to believe.
You wouldn't find that happening today. The Democrat's going to win California no matter who the Democrat is, and a Republican right now is going to win Texas no matter who the Republican is. And it looks like a Republican will win in Louisiana in the presidential election for time unforeseen. But Landrieu goes against all that tide and somehow, some way, is still competitive. If she loses, it'll be close. But if she loses, what does that do to the Democratic Party in Louisiana?
Well, just to first sort of address your first point about going against the tide. Again, it's not her struggle is certainly to make sure that people realize it's not President Obama on the ticket. It's her. He's not going to be here, but for another 2 years. So it's her challenge. And her campaign's challenge to remind people, look, this is important. You can't just vote to be anti-Obama. You need to vote what's best for Louisiana, what's best for the country. And I think she makes a very, very strong point that a vote for her is best for Louisiana and best for the country.
In the congressional race yesterday, the candidates in your former district, where you held the post for 8 memorable months in the 6th district, they were asked a variety of questions on minimum wage. All 4 Republicans, Dietzel, Graves, Whitney, and Clater, all against an increase in minimum wage. Edwin Edwards says, let's bring it to $10.20 an hour. Does that surprise you, or is that pretty much a given when you have Democrats and Republicans in the same place?
Well, again, I don't think it's a Republican idea. I think it's more of a far-right idea that a minimum wage is bad. I heard one of the Republicans were quoted as saying that no, people shouldn't be making minimum wage. They should be just working harder. Now, to me, that's just a lack of insight into the people who are affected by this. Yeah, there are teenagers that are working in minimum wage jobs, but that's only about 11%. Most of these are working mothers with 1 and 2 jobs trying to make ends meet. And so to say that they should just be working harder is pretty insensitive and doesn't address the problem. Now, the argument against minimum wage is always that it's going to raise the price of consumer goods, that it's bad for the economy. However, the studies just don't show that. I mean, I think for a while that may have been, the economists may have agreed that could happen, but I think, that was in the 90s, and I think since then, the research and the data shows that it doesn't hurt the economy. In fact, it helps the economy by, 70% of our economy is based on consumption. So if you give a wage increase from 7.25 to 10.25, that injects billions of dollars into our economy. So I think it actually has just the opposite impact that some of these guys are saying.
Mm-hmm. Now, Congressman Cassidy, who signed that Grover Norquist pledge to never be in favor of any new taxes, he is, and I think it is a brave stand, and one, for whatever reason, he's digging in on, he's in favor of raising the Social Security age. And in fairness to him, if it was 65 when it was put in, people are living longer and working at older ages now. Would it be unreasonable to raise it to 70?
Well, I mean, certainly Social Security, we're looking at Social Security issues really by 2033. I think some people are saying that it will reach the level of insolvency. So something's got to be done. Again, it could be adjusting the benefits, or it could be raising the Social Security taxes. And I know neither one of those are attractive ideas. I do believe it's not something that's going to happen in a campaign type context. I think it's better with some of these independent groups, although so far the Simpson Bowles and these guys have not gotten any traction, but I don't think you're going to be able to solve it in an election. But yes, I know Congressman Cassidy has
he used to be a senator, though.
Yeah, that's right, advocated for raising that, and I think he's also talking about the vouchers for Medicare, which that's a big difference than the Democratic platform. Certainly a big difference than Senator Landrieu's ideas.
Well, Don Casu is correct that in the latest poll commissioned by Raycom, I believe, 23% of the electorate is undecided, and it probably is related largely to all the negative campaigning. People don't like any of the candidates right now. This negative campaigning, as much as people lament the tone of it, it seems to work.
Well, it works in terms of pulling off voters from your opponent, or making sure voters don't vote for your opponent. But it certainly does tamp down participation. And so, yeah, I think that's what you're seeing. I think I agree with you. The 23% is probably to some degree a reflection of the negative ads, but I think it's also it's voters trying to decide what's right. You got a lot of voters who don't like President Obama, but are still torn with trying to say to determine whether or not Senator Landrieu is going to help Louisiana more than the Congressman Cassidy could.
All right, here's a tough one from a listener. How does a law and order guy like you bite the bullet and vote for Edwin Edwards?
I don't know if I'll get into that discussion, Jim. I don't want to. I don't want to be disrespectful to anybody, and the governor is.
But on the issues, it would seem that he is more in line with you.
Certainly,
But there is. A prison term that preceded the campaign.
Certainly, but yes, his views are more in line than a lot of the other candidates.
Well, we'll talk a few more minutes with Don Casu, and we'll have some other interesting guests in our final segment. 297-5633. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We shall return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633. A few more minutes with former Congressman Don Casu. Rinaldi and Sherwood. Rinaldi, please be brief. You're on with Don Casu.
Congressman Casu, could you kind of square the hypocrisy of the Republican Party? For example, if we were to let the thousands of millions of illegal immigrants that are working in the United States be taxed like the rest of us working stiffs, perhaps that could help with some of the insolvency with Social Security and a number of other ills. So in other words, they're trying to put up a big fence, but these folks are already working here and are supported by large industry.
Well, the immigration policy is certainly not working as it is now, and I think everybody knows that. And so figuring out the solution to that is a big deal, and you're right. If we can figure out how to get these guys in the system to be paying taxes and not to have to be hiding out, may actually be beneficial to our economy.
Joe on guard ear. Hi, Joe. You're on with Don.
Jim, I just wanted to make a couple of general comments about raising the retirement age.
Yes, sir.
My best friend's first Social Security check arrived at his house 3 days after he died. And I know another gentleman who died on the way home from his retirement party. And I had two friends to die at age 51 after working 30 years on a job. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and Jim, in Louisiana, you know, we live actually shorter than most people across the country. So that would affect us more than anybody.
And generally speaking, people without means
certainly live
shorter lives. So some would say this would punish those who have the least.
Certainly, they're.
Charlotte in Iberia. Charlotte, good morning. You're on with Don.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling to thank your guest for being in favor of the minimum wage being at a livable wage and a livable level, because it was established by law and set so a person working a normal number of hours could support a family at acceptable levels or acceptable standards, in stark contrast to your guest a couple of days ago who was ridiculing people who were in favor of an acceptable level for minimum wage. So thanks again. Bye-bye.
And you know that, Jim, it's sort of ironic. It actually, by requiring a livable wage, we actually reduce benefits to people. We actually reduce government dependency. So I just think it's, when I'd say it's not, when I said it was not a Republican thing, I mean that. I think it's, I do think that it's a almost a conservative principle. It should be to allow people to get out of poverty, to allow people to make it on their own without depending on government, and have the autonomy of self-autonomy, I think is an important concept for both Democrats and Republicans.
Okay, a final question online from Mike Wolf. He says, what changes, if any, do you think should be made to federal criminal law? Federal criminal law.
Oh, Mike, I just got out of the Department of Justice where I had to be very apolitical with those issues. So let me have a few more months out of that position before I embark on that.
All right. Well, Don is now a former U.S. attorney. He was U.S. attorney longer than he was a congressman. Graduate twice of LSU and of Georgetown Law School, and you're now in the talk about the private sector. You're in the private sector. Do you like it?
Oh, I love it. It gives me the opportunity to help people like we were able to do, you know, when I was in the state house, you know, with constituent services. So it's very rewarding work, and I'm very fortunate to have some good people working with me, and a good partner. Lane Ewing is smart guy. Stan Lamell is a genius, and has been around the federal criminal system for 35 years. So I'm very, very fortunate, Jim.
Well, obviously, many still treasure your insights on politics. So hopefully we can do this again soon.
Well, thanks for having me here. I know this is one of your last, I think you have two more weeks here at WRKF, and I wanted to thank you for allowing me the honor to be here.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate it. You came on this show back in 2008 when you were somewhat in the position that Congressman Cassidy is right now. I think it would have been easier for you and maybe more strategic just to be quiet and see what happens, but you came on the show and took your chances. You fought the good fight and lost to Congressman Cassidy, and we hope that sometime soon he'll resurface on
I'm
this
sure
show.
He will. I'm okay. Sure he will. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. We're joined now by Stanley Wilder, the new dean of the LSU Libraries. He is a man who was large and in charge at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, before coming here on July 1st, and good morning to you, Dean Wilder.
Good morning to you. Thank you for having me.
And what prompted the move from Charlotte, which is a beautiful city, and a large one, to a smaller place?
Well, it's actually a bigger place from my point of view as a research library director. Moving to LSU in Baton Rouge was a career move. The LSU Libraries is a phenomenal library, and I think the LSU as a whole is poised for a renaissance. So I think there's all sorts of good work to be done here.
More than 3 million titles.
Three and a half.
Three
That's
and
right.
a half. at the LSU library. But then again, some would say now with the world we have, I have as much information in my pocket as you do in your library.
That's actually not the case, though, because the kind of material that students and faculty need to do their work, it costs money. In such a way that if you were to take out your cell phone and search Google, you would not be able to find the kind of material that researchers need to do their work.
Now, you're an active researcher. You get into the books that are on the shelf. It's an art that still is in existence, isn't it?
It does exist in some disciplines more than others, but you know, we're finding that that even in what we call the bookbound disciplines like history and English, there's an increasing amount of reliance on databases and other forms of digital information. I think that the whole world is changing mm-hmm. on this.
Well, Stanley Wilder began his career as the manager of the Architecture and Art Library at University of Illinois at Chicago.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, and you have a bachelor's degree from Wisconsin, master's from Columbia, and then you got your doctorate from...
It's an MBA degree.
MBA from the University of Illinois at Chicago. So you've been in some pretty big places.
Right, yes.
But not in the South, other than Charlotte, which is, you're moving this way, but now you're in the Deep South. How's your transformation going?
Well, actually, that transformation happened in 1989. I'm in my second stint at LSU. I got a job at the LSU libraries in 89 and worked there for 10 years. So I love and know Louisiana, and there was nothing in the category of surprise in terms of culturally.
Yeah, you knew what you were getting into.
Yeah.
And LSU, we think of the Middleton Library, but there's the Hill Memorial, which is a crown jewel that some people don't know anything about.
Right, and the Hill Memorial Library is one of the world's great libraries. It's we have collections there that specialize in the region and the state, but really in all sorts of subjects. People travel from all over the world to do their research at Hill Memorial Library. It's really a national treasure, that collection.
And what's going on in the near term that we can be cognizant of regarding the LSU libraries?
Well, the first thing I'll mention is that last week we opened a new exhibit at the Hill Memorial Library, which is the Smith-Lever Act exhibit, which commemorates the 100th anniversary of the cooperative extension idea. LSU had a very strong role to play in that, and there's lots of interesting history and documentation about the growth of the state from an agricultural point of view, and that exhibit is open to the public at Hill Memorial Library.
Well, we wish you well, and don't want you to be a stranger. And any parting thoughts about your new venture, which is now 3 months and 20 days old?
Well, I think that this is the privilege of a lifetime to be able to have this opportunity, helping to lead a renaissance, really, at LSU.
Well, thank you, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you.
Stanley Wilder, Dean of LSU Libraries. And now we're joined in studio by Commander Kirk Lipple.
Yes, sir.
Okay, a man who looks like a commander and is an accomplished author. You wrote about an attack involving the United States in 2000 in Front Burner. Let's start with that. You know a little bit about the hostilities that are ongoing in the world, and in particular, a part of the world that is volatile today.
Absolutely. I was privileged enough to be in command of USS Cole when we pulled into this little port at the southwest corner of the Arabian Peninsula called Aden, Yemen. We left our home port of Norfolk, Virginia in August, had operated in the Mediterranean. And when we pulled in that morning, we were expecting to be there for only 6 to 8 hours, taking on about 250,000 gallons of fuel. We had started pumping around 10:30, when at 11:18 that morning, there was a thunderous explosion.
You're right. From a first-person account, this was October 12, 2000, so 14 years ago, 14 years and 9 days. And you were fortunate to come out of that alive.
I was very fortunate. Unfortunately, I did lose 17 of my crew were killed, 37 were wounded, but I was also blessed with a phenomenal crew that despite the fact that the announcing system and the backup systems failed, the alarm system failed, and there was complete silence, they divided very quickly into three groups to either save the ship, do triage to save their shipmates, mm-hmm. or provide security to stop another attack. Within a little over an hour, we had the ship stable, and as a testament to how well the crew did, that first day we would evacuate 33 wounded off the ship in 99 minutes, and of those 33, 32 would survive.
And the bombing of the Cole was Al-Qaeda's first direct assault on the U.S.
Actually, it was not. If you look back in history, 1993, World Trade Center 1 was an Al-Qaeda-inspired attack, tangentially involved with the attack at Khobar Towers. And then, of course, you had the attack on the embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya in 1998. We were attacked in 2000, and it was a fundamentally different attack. Previously, when you attack those buildings, those are things that house and represent mm-hmm. U.S. interests. A warship is something that defends our citizens and our national security interests around the world. And when you try to take away a nation's ability to defend itself, it's an act of war. And unfortunately, we had one administration under President Clinton who chose to just want to wrap up the investigation and get out of office without leaving any potential political baggage on the table. But by the same token, you had the Bush administration come in that took an attitude of, we're forward-looking, not backward-acting.
Well, while, of course, it happened on the previous guy's watch, which makes it a bit easier, but you sound a bit bitter about this.
Well, the way I would put it is, I think we as Americans need to realize that no party owns national security. It is the responsibility of us as Americans to ensure that the people we get and put into office at a national level, which is why it's so important to bring it back down home here to Louisiana, is because those decisions can have ramifications for how our nation defends itself. And while we'll never be able to answer the question, had we responded to the attack on Cole, would we have detected the planning for 9/11? Doing nothing sealed our fate, which we cannot afford to do.
Well, the attack on September 11th, 2001, do the math, it was just under 11 months later, and you're saying the Cole was a precursor to what happened
Absolutely.
In New York and Washington and Pennsylvania.
Absolutely. And even the 9/11 Commission said in their investigation that because of our non-response to the attack on USS Cole, it emboldened bin Laden and his followers to continue the planning mm-hmm. for that attack. And unfortunately, when we pulled in that morning into the port of Aden, we had no idea from an intelligence perspective that Al-Qaeda had been in that port for over a year. They had been watching when Navy ships pulled in, what pier mm-hmm. they went to, what boats came out. So when we contracted for three garbage barges that morning, two had come out and taken off trash. Mm-hmm. And when the third boat came out, little did we know, it was two suicide bombers with a boat full of explosives as a waterborne IED that came to the exact spot in the middle of the ship where the other barge had been and detonated.
We're visiting with Kirk Lippold, who was the commander of the Cole, October of 2000, and he is in Baton Rouge, and he's written about his experience in Front Burner. Now, these things unfortunately happen under various administrations. Ronald Reagan had an embarrassment in Beirut that over 200 Americans died in that one.
Terrorism's actually been with us a long time.
Yeah, is there any way to completely safeguard our country from this kind of attack?
I don't think there is ever going to be a 100% positive safeguard way to do it. All I know is that we have to look back in history and use that as a reference point. And you talk to any World War II veteran that fought in either the South Pacific or over in Europe, and they will tell you whatever you have to do to fight the enemy over there rather than allowing them to come here is what we need to do. And that's why it's so important. I think a lot of people, while they very much these days want to disengage and completely withdraw from the problems going mm-hmm. on, whether it's Iraq, regardless of the reasons we got there, or whether it's in Afghanistan, you have to think back and say, well, what would Germany and Japan have looked like if we had pulled out in 1950? Would South Korea look like?
We're going to try to see. You've got people fired up. We'll slide
on one.
Mike on Perkins, quickly, your question. Hi, Mike.
Yes, sir. Admiral Mike Mullen was on the Stephen Colbert show not too long ago, and he expressed his, lack of confidence in our political leadership in basically in our national security interests in keeping us safe from terrorism.
All right. Is that still the case?
Well, I think it's surprising that Mike Mullen would do that, being as tied to this administration as he is right now. I mean, while he may express some misgivings in how it's being handled, I would look at it and say there are clearly some policy differences in how I would see things done. I have been a very strong advocate since I was in on the development of Guantanamo Bay. We do need a place where we can bring terrorists to allow them to be humanely interrogated and kept. Mm-hmm. But I think there are some issues worldwide right. that the Admiral brought up.
And why are you in Baton Rouge today?
Main reason I'm in Baton Rouge is because to lend support for Garrett Graves, who's running for Congress.
So you'll be on the trail with Garrett Graves?
I wouldn't say I'm on the trail. We're doing an event tonight where mostly it's for veterans. Well, and it's an opportunity for me to thank mm-hmm. those who choose to serve our nation and for Garrett to have an opportunity to interface with them.
Two good-looking guys out there making the case that Garrett Graves should succeed Bill Cassidy in Congress. And thank you, Commander Lippold, for your service to our country and your appearance with us today.
Well, thank you, and thanks you for all the support that people out there give to those who choose to serve.
And stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.